Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
One of the things about the media that I find so annoying is that there's just no accountability. This is a profession where we call people and demand answers and get pissed off if people won't reply. It's like, oh, no comment. That just must mean that they're guilty, which in often can be the case. And if you have enough evidence, fine. But we demand accountability from others. We get upset when people won't reply to our questions. And when we're wrong, people rarely apologize. It's just like, no, let's go on to the next story and never really acknowledge that we fucked up the last one.
Hey, Parallax Views listeners, on this edition of the program, we're having a little bit of a state of the media address with veteran muckraking journalist Ken Silverstein of Washington Babylon, the website featuring shocking true stories and political sleaze, which Ken describes as an attempt to cover DC politicians and journalists like Hollywood celebrities, not the way they are worshipped by our current media masters. Ken sounds off with his criticisms of the press in the age of Trump. Now, don't get it mixed up. Ken is not a fan of Donald Trump, but he does believe that the press has been reckless during his presidency. For example, the recent Jeffrey Goldberg article in The Atlantic, which accused Trump of disrespecting American troops. Ken and I hone in on that particular story, as well as a few others. Hell, we even get into the Jeffrey Epstein case. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now on to the conversation with Ken Silverstein of Washington Babylon. Welcome to Parallax Views, journalist Ken Silverstein of Washington Babylon, the website of shocking true stories and political sleaze. And, you know, there's a lot of political sleaze to go around, so I think Washington Babylon is a website that we need a lot more of.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. And there, yes, certainly an abundance of sleaze to be covering. I've been a little slow lately. You know, journalism is not the easiest profession these days. There are no easy professions these days unless you're in the 1%. We're all hustlers and, you know, running around doing 3 and 4 jobs and everything else. I haven't been terribly active, but I hope to get a little bit more productive and get back to things. But when the website's going well, I think it's a pretty interesting read. So I'm hoping to, revive it, because we're still publishing from time to time, but it's been a slow period. But thank you for your kind words.
So Ken, I guess where I wanted to start out, I may have younger listeners that are just sort of getting into politics after the sort of Bernie moment, or during the Bernie moment, as it were, and maybe they're unfamiliar with your work, although they shouldn't be, because it's great work. Maybe you could explain how you got into journalism.
Sure. I was in university at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, an absolutely terrific school. This was, let's just say, some decades back. I don't like to think about the aging process, but it's been a while. But I actually, weirdly enough, I grew up in the city in St. Louis, Missouri. And I had heard about Evergreen, which is an alternative college, but a state-supported alternative college. So not one of these really flaky, there were back then some alternative colleges, which I think were, I don't know, for rich kids only and really didn't do much in the way of education. But I was radicalized at Evergreen. But curiously, I've never been huge on the outdoors. I'm an urban type, but I, for some strange reason, I decided, oh, I'll go out to Evergreen and I'll become interested in the environment and blah, blah, blah. But it turned out that the first year I had to take a class called Voices of the Third World, which was taught by someone to this day who I owe an enormous debt of gratitude to, York Wong, who was a professor at the time at Evergreen, just an, you know, really inspiring figure, got me interested in politics. And the way I decided to go into journalism, because I really had no clue. Nobody really knows what the hell they're going to do when they're 18 or 19 years old, or most people don't. But I discovered the Village Voice in the college library, and I became a huge fan of Alexander Coburn, who I hope most of your listeners are familiar with.
The founder of Counterpunch, along with yourself, yes.
Yeah. I have to say, just to take some, blow my own horn a little, I actually was the founder of Counterpunch. I love Alex, so taking nothing away from him. But I founded Counterpunch. He joined about 3 or 4 months later. And I had interned for him at The Nation. Then I went to Brazil for a couple of years to work for Associated Press. So I'm actually telling you about how, you know, my early years in journalism. But it was really reading Alex. I discovered the Village Voice, which I'd never heard of. He had this, you know, an amazing column called Press Clips. And
Can I comment on that real quick?
Yeah, of course.
Those Village Voice columns, I've read a few of them, and they're brilliantly incisive in a way that you don't really see it today in many political commentary columns. It's not stuff you'll see from, you know, a Tom Friedman. Alexander Coburn was, you know, he was a firecracker, and it makes me sad to see how, you know, the media went after him for a while, I think in the 80s or 90s, before he founded Counterpunch. It's really unfortunate.
Yeah, Alex was just one of the most brilliant polemicists. Just an absolute delight to read. Any of your listeners who are not familiar with Alex's work, go back and, you know, just do a Google search for Alexander Coburn and the Village Voice and Press Clips. And the stuff was just phenomenal. And also, once again, to blow my own horn, we worked together for quite a while. Jeffrey St. Clair, another great journalist, took over my role at Counterpunch when I left. And Alex, unfortunately, died a few years ago. And Jeffrey continues to run Counterpunch. But Alex and I collaborated on a lot of work, including a book called Washington Babylon, where I clearly stole the name for the blog or for the website. I also, when I was at Harper's Magazine, I did a blog called Washington Babylon. But he should be an inspiration to all upcoming lefty journalists, and not just lefty journalists. I mean, he was, you know, he was a little bit eclectic in his politics and held views that might surprise some of your listeners, some readers.
Yeah, I was going to say it's interesting that you mentioned that sometimes Alexander could rile some feathers. I know near the end of his life, he had some views on global warming that upset a lot of people on the left. In the 90s, he was sort of interested in the militia movement, although he wasn't, you know, someone that was saying, oh, the militia movement's great. It was sort of, you know, seeing them as being allies or people that we could flip. He had interesting ideas, but I don't think people should dismiss everything he wrote, even if we disagree with certain things he said in the past.
I totally agree with you. I mean, I've had this very same conversation increasingly in the last few months. I mean, there are certain people, I don't know, there's this attitude now. I feel like, you know, Twitter and social media are just incredibly unhealthy. I mean, there are people who I've long admired, and I didn't always agree with Alex. I mean, you know, some of his views I just thought were completely wrong. But so what? I mean, does that mean that I, you know, just write him off as hopelessly corrupt? I mean, nowadays, like, you know, you write something on Twitter and, you know, if you happen to annoy enough people, or you just, for the simple reason that they disagree with you, you know, it's like your entire history becomes worthless. You become, you know, like your entire history becomes to reduce to this one thing you wrote that happens to piss people off. And then it's really bizarre. It's like I once wrote on Twitter, you know, if Twitter was a jury, Manson would have walked, because, you know, there's just like this viciousness to it. And I confess I've really tried to stop doing this because it's just so dumb and such a waste of time. But there's a viciousness to it that's just truly annoying. And yeah, I mean, you write one thing, and I mean, like, for example, Matt Taibbi, who has written things that recently that I don't always agree with, but he has a long history in lefty journalism. So even if I strongly disagree with him, that doesn't mean that I, you know, am suddenly going to conclude, oh, everything he did for the last 20 or 30 years is useless. You know, I mean, people are always, you know, I don't know, if you write something that annoys people, then it can't simply be a difference of opinion. It has to be because the other person is corrupt or stupid or,
well,
you know.
The way I think of it is, you know, people can be wrong. And in this circle of journalists, we don't have a lot of people like yourself or Matt, or, you know, there's a great other many lefty-leaning journalists out there. But we don't have as many in the world as there are hacks like Tom Friedman or Jeffrey Goldberg.
Yes, exactly. And writing people off and just questioning their entire body of work and everything else. It's like, have a, you know, there are some there, and there are journalists who I just, on the left as well as on the right, who, to be perfectly honest, I simply just don't trust. But these are people who I never trust. You know, I mean, a guy like Taibbi, who's been around for a long time, why am I going to suddenly just decide that nothing he says has any value because I disagree with him about certain issues? I mean, you know, we're all wrong from time to time. If you're not willing to rethink your ideas or just to block off opposing points of view, it's really not a healthy way to live. And it's not a healthy intellectual stance. And that's what I find. I got onto Twitter in 2015. I racked up a whole bunch of followers, and then I just got so annoyed with it, I deleted my account, and then decided to get back on because as a journalist, you almost have to be on. But it's just a really unhealthy venue. And I think it's, you know, people who spend too much time on it are really getting, I mean, there's just this attitude, this bubble attitude. It's like you're in my bubble or you're out of it.
It's total negativity. It's total negativity all the time. That's the sort of thing that gets rewarded most on a media platform like Twitter. And it just gets to be too much at times, where it's almost like there's these cults of personality around hating certain individuals.
Yes.
Because, oh, they said something that was off brand. You know, oh, we don't agree with that, so now we have to turn on them completely. Whereas I just like to analyze what they're saying and take the good and, you know, throw out the bad.
Yeah, I agree. And I, you know, there are a whole bunch of writers who have been sort of kicked out of, or not kicked out. I mean, you know, the term cancel culture, I want to be a little bit careful with, because, I mean, a lot of people claim to have been canceled who have mammoth platforms. And I find that whole idea a little bit ridiculous. I also find that, you know, it's become known as a term that the left is canceling people, where clearly people on the left have much less media access and power than people on the right. So the idea that the left is canceling massive numbers of people and blocking opinions, I mean, it does happen, of course, but I don't know. The way that the term has been twisted is a little bit disturbing in my point of view.
I was going to add, you know, one thing I find really interesting about Washington Babylon, which I assume that because it's a website devoted to sort of covering Washington, D.C. figures like they're Hollywood celebrities rather than these figures that are worshipped in the media, that you kind of took the name maybe from Kenneth Anger's Hollywood Babylon, which is a rather hilarious little historical document at this point. But it's interesting to me because I feel as if a lot of the mainstream media now is trying to be like, I don't know, a version of Washington Babylon, but in a way that like isn't really very critical. You know, they want to cover a new scandal every single day almost, but not all of these scandals necessarily have much meat to them.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that time and time again, and I would love to get to some of those stories because one of the things about the media that I find so annoying is that there's just no accountability. This is a profession where we call people and demand answers and get pissed off if people won't reply. It's like, oh, no comment. That just must mean that they're guilty, which in often can be the case. And if you have enough evidence, fine. But we demand accountability from others. We get upset when people won't reply to our questions. And when we're wrong, people rarely apologize. It's just like, no, let's go on to the next story and never really acknowledge that we fucked up the last one, if I'm allowed to say that. Mm-hmm. So it's a really frustrating, to me, it's really outlandish because we just, you know, hey, First Amendment, journalists think of themselves, I mean, my God, there's never been a profession that gives itself so many awards. And we, you know, we demand accountability from others, and yet we as journalists are extraordinarily unaccountable. At the same time, I do want to say that I critique the media a lot. I do think, unlike there are some journalists on the left and on the right who dismiss everything the mainstream journalism does, that mainstream journalism does, as suspect and unreliable, until, of course, you know, somebody from the New York Times or the Washington Post writes a story that is, you know, these people find conveniently handy to cite. I do think there's tremendous work that is done in the mainstream media. There are great investigations. So I don't want to.
There was that one in the New Yorker just a few days ago, the man who refused to spy, the Iranian scientist the FBI tried to recruit. And then he says, no, I'm not going to do it. And I guess they detained him, right?
Incredible story by Laura Secor. I actually tweeted it out today and said, because I didn't get to it until last night. And I said, you know, this is an astonishing story and I'm rarely astonished anymore. It's just, I mean,
they accused him of spying, right?
Well, what they did was
detention center.
It's a complicated story, and so it's a delight to read, though. But I mean, basically, they gave a visa to an Iranian scientist to come to the United States. It turned out to be, I have never heard of this, basically a bogus visa where they're giving you a visa that is actually not legitimate, and then when you get here. Like he got to the United States and was immediately pulled aside because it's a visa they give people with the intent of interrogating them as soon as they get here. And this guy was, they tried to coerce him to spy on the Iranian government. And he was not involved in, you know, any Iranian nuclear program. He had not done, I mean, he had family in the United States. It's a heartbreaking story. What they did to him, I mean, at this point in time, you know, anybody who believes that the United States is operating under, you know, the strict rule of law has to be pretty naive. But if you read this story, it's utterly shocking. I mean, every day. I mean, for, you know, for the last few months, things happen and you just go, this really can't be the case. But this story is really extraordinary. Everyone should read it. I mean, it's, you know, we're increasingly a lawless country. I mean, the idea, you know, to even describe the United States as a democracy at this point, and I don't, you know, I know some people will say, oh, what, this is being ridiculous, but it's not ridiculous. We're in a, I do not believe we are a fascist a government. I think that's overstating the case, but it's, you know, an authoritarian government in many, many ways. And it, you know, the level of democracy has been severely diluted. I mean, you know, from the Electoral College, the economic or the political power of the wealthiest people.
Well, even going back to the even going back to the Bush years. I mean, now the image of George W. Bush has been rehabilitated. He's sort of this, aw shucks, why can't we just have Bush again? He's so much better than Trump type thing in the media. And I don't understand it, because to me, Bush paved the way for figures like Trump in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah, he's a really repellent figure. This tends to happen a lot, of course, because the, you know, the next president always somehow manages to be worse than the last one. If Trump loses, I mean, I'm not sure, in some ways, Trump can be topped. I'm not sure. Well, certainly if he loses, I guess, you know, there'll be some nostalgia for him amongst his base, but I don't think you'll see the same sort of rehabilitation of Trump.
I don't know. I could see us getting, you know, President Tucker Carlson or President Peter Thiel at some point, and it being horrifying.
Actually, at this point, I rule nothing out. I mean, I remember a few months ago, again, I've been trashing Twitter and I try to spend less and less time on it. But I remember tweeting something saying, it was a joke, just saying, you know, I don't remember exactly what time it was, but I said something like, it's 7:33 p.m. on whatever day and things could not possibly get any worse. And the next day the port blew up in Beirut. So I'm like, okay, I'm never even going to joke about this again. So yeah, who knows? I mean, things, and it really is true, given where the country is headed, even, you know, I really dislike Joe Biden. He has a long, long track record that I find very unattractive. And Kamala Harris is someone else who I have, you know, utterly no respect for. I do think the best outcome of this election would be for Trump to lose. I'm not going to vote in Washington, D.C. because my vote doesn't count here and I don't want to participate in this charade. But I think the better outcome, despite Biden's multiple egregious shortcomings and the fact that, you know, people will say, oh, the threat is gone, which it's not going to be gone. Biden is not going to do anything to address the fundamental problems that exist in this country, which are severe and growing.
I want to comment on that as well, because, you know, people are like telling me that, oh, if Biden gets in, everything goes back to normal. And I'm thinking to myself, you have people running for Congress right now in November that are believers in this QAnon conspiracy, and some of them are going to get those seats. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking to myself, this is not going to just end when Trump goes away. I mean, he has that 30% base that believes in the
I think it's closer to 40%. Sorry to interrupt, but I think it's still closer to 40%.
Yeah, 30 to 40% is the figure I always hear, yes.
Yeah, but anyway, you were saying.
I was just saying, Trump's base is not going away after the election, and they're not going to go quietly into that good night.
No, definitely not. And also, you said, you know, and I agree with you, you hear this a lot. People say, oh, if Biden wins, things go back to normal. Well, normal sucked. I mean, the Obama years were a catastrophe for most people in this country. I mean, just a transfer of income upward, which has, you know, now just been ratcheted up under Trump. But I mean, the same policies, the same broad policies of favoring business, cutting away at regulations. I mean, neoliberalism was a catastrophe. You know, I mean, under Democrats or Republicans, we are living under this set of rules that, you know, it really is. I mean, I you know, this is something, it's a slogan I know, but, you know, capitalism is organized crime. And never more so than in the case of the United States in the year 2020. And well, so, you know, but 2016, I mean, returning to normal would still be terrible. We cannot return to normal and normal means an incredible number of people don't have health care.
Well, I was going to say in that regard, I mean, normal, I think, to the Democratic Party establishment means what Rahm Emanuel said just a day ago. He said it's going to be the year of the Biden Republican. So now the Democrats are just openly saying we're going to be Republican Party light. And I'm like, if that's the new normal.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's incredibly discouraging. I mean, this, you know, the Democratic Party began moving quite far to the right. I mean, Jimmy Carter has been a very good ex-president. He was not a very good president, and he was, you know, a conservative Southerner. But really, it was Clinton where the, you know, we don't need to spend a lot of time on this. I mean, it's a well-known story, but Clinton was captured by corporate interest, and it's the start of the time where the Democratic Party became, except on social issues, pretty much indistinguishable from the Republican Party, and certainly on fundamental economic issues. I don't want to say they're indistinguishable. And I do not believe the Democratic Party can be reformed in any way. There's no way to turn it into a vehicle for progress. I will say, you know, I don't know what your views on this are. I do get frustrated with some people on the left. I mean, look, AOC is not perfect, but I'm sorry, she's a lot better than Joe Crowley. So I am glad she was elected.
And I think, agree.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's ridiculous to just say there's absolutely no difference. You know, both parties suck, fine. But, you know, I really admire Congresswoman Omar in Minnesota. There are some members of Congress who truly are different, but they are not, you know, so to pretend that AOC, I mean, yeah, she said, we were talking earlier about Alexander Coburn. Yeah, he said things I disagreed with. Big deal. So what? I mean, AOC is not, you know, she has views that I don't share.
But she's not Nancy Pelosi.
She is not Nancy Pelosi. And anybody who tries to make that argument is being preposterous. You know, I feel like as journalists, it's really another annoying characteristic of journalism and journalists is this demand for perfection. I mean, we have a different job. We can be as annoying and outspoken and outspoken as we want to be, but AOC, I mean, she's pretty much, I think, got a lock on that seat. She probably has much bigger ambitions. But, you know, if you're running for office, there are certain things that you can't say them. I'm terribly sorry. Or they're very, very difficult to say. But when I see people like AOC and Omar talking about U.S. imperialism and questioning support for Israel and really, and using the word socialism, which proudly, I'm really, really sorry. I do greatly prefer AOC to Crowley. And
well, it's a step in the right direction, if nothing else.
Look, it's better than nothing, for God's sake. It's definitely a step in the right direction. And, you know, I mean, if you want to just, you know, bitch and moan all day, fine. But it's just, to me, it's a stupid criticism. I mean, she's distinctly better than Crowley. I mean, there are some of these races where I really just can't get excited. I mean, the mere fact that a Democrat is going to replace a Republican does not necessarily, for me, mean that I'm going to get on board with that. I mean, I have a lot of contempt for the Democratic Party, which is dominated by, and Rahm Emanuel is a much more powerful figure in the party than AOC. And I do believe AOC and the squad and, you know, this, you know, progressives that have been elected, they're dreaming if they think they're going to transform this party into a useful vehicle for progressive change. But they're better than the vast majority and generally better than, significantly better than their opponents.
If I could, I want to go back to something. If we could, we mentioned the Iran spying and coronavirus detention camp story that came out in The New Yorker. It's interesting because I feel like stories like that are the ones we should be covering rather than, you know, what did Trump tweet today? That's what's bizarre to me about the media ecosystem right now.
Definitely. And there are, I mean, in fairness, and again, I do, I find it really annoying when people just write up the entire mainstream media. You can, you know, I haven't read the New York Times today, but there may be a really good story in the New York Times. They do some great work. So, that New Yorker piece was extraordinary. I mean, you know, that is just flat out great journalism.
I mean, I'll even comment on what you're saying there. People have gotten mad at me because I will even defend journalists that I don't always agree with. You know, for example, some of the White House press reporters, Brian Karam in particular, has been really outspoken at the press briefings with Trump. And I don't always agree with Karam, but I kind of like that he's a pugilist. And right. I'll defend him on that account. And I don't like that Trump sort of attacks the press in a very unnuanced way. So I think there's a lot of nuance to be had when it comes to media criticism. We can defend journalists on one end, but we can criticize them on another.
Absolutely. And I agree with you. I mean, I've seen, my God, just, you know, even from the White House press corps, there are some really good stories. I will say, now this is something, again, I'm not sure your view on this exactly. I mean, I agree with you that for the most part, the media is covering the wrong issues. And there's this obsession with Trump and what he's tweeting and what he's saying. I do see people like liberals, journalists saying, just don't cover his press conferences. Well, I'm sorry, but you do have to cover his press conferences.
No, I think you definitely do. I think you definitely do.
Yeah. I mean, he's the president. If he says crazy shit, then point out that it's crazy shit. But the idea that just don't let him have the space, you just can't do that. But I do think, the one thing that I would say about the coverage of Trump, though, is that a lot of it is reckless and a lot of it has been proven false. Parts of the Russiagate story have been proven true, but I think the broad story, which people don't talk about now because like a lot of what was reported was just bogus, but really initially the original story and what a lot of Americans still believe is that Trump is an asset of Russian intelligence and that, you know, Putin has stuff on him and is able to get him to do what he wants. And
I've always thought that Russiagate, not to interrupt you, but I've always thought that Russiagate was more, that it probably had more to do with Trump and money laundering and, you know, figures from Russia like Semyon Moglovich than it did directly with Putin.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and he did launder a lot of money, including Russian money, corrupt Russian money, overseas, like in Panama, he had a property where a ton of corrupt Russian money went in. It's not impossible that there was some knowledge on the part of government officials in Russia the Panama project dates to 2006. There's no way they knew in 2006 that Trump was going to be president. But I do believe, like, you know, Russia would have been keeping an eye on Trump because he was an eccentric millionaire or billionaire who, you know, was visiting Eastern Europe and had gone to Russia. I mean, naturally, like any, in the same way that U.S. intelligence would have been keeping an eye on a prominent Chinese or Russian business or government official. But I don't think they were running him. And I do think that most of the, in fact, I mean, I think that's preposterous. But certainly he laundered a lot of money from corrupt Russian money into his development, his real estate projects. He also laundered in a lot of corrupt Saudi money and Brazilian money and Venezuelan money and Colombian money and Argentine money. It wasn't just Russian money. I mean, Trump, they did basically zero due diligence. I mean, they were developing these projects and just taking money from wherever they could get it.
That's the actual story, not just of Russia and Trump. I mean, Trump I had a guest, J.P. Satilli, the news vandal, who said that basically the way you need to look at Trump and his presidency is that he's not acting necessarily so much as a president as a big licensing deal. And it's a licensing deal for everyone, you know, the United Arab Emirates, Turkey. He basically is just making deals with people, and it's being run as a business.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's generally correct. And I think that that's the real, I mean, there are multiple scandals. I mean, there are multiple scandals in the Trump administration. Classic, you know, just conflict of interest, financial enrichment, on and on and on. And yet the press seized on this story of Russiagate and won't let it go.
And they're still doing it. I mean, the Russian bounty story in Afghanistan, which I don't even know that's been really backed up besides anonymous sources.
It hasn't been backed up except for anonymous sources. And in fact, it's disputed by the NSA. That was, these are the stories that I think are extremely damaging in the end to the media's credibility, and where Trump's base, who are not all, a lot of Trump's, there's a component of Trump's base that I find genuinely scary. I mean, the gun-toting militia types are, completely bonkers in my view. But there's an element of, not everybody who backs Trump is, an idiot. I don't agree that he's going to solve their problems, but people are, this country is broken, I don't think is too strong a word. It was broken in 2016. That's why half the population doesn't bother voting. It doesn't.
I got to tell you, here in Pennsylvania, I know for a fact that there are people in 2016 that voted for Trump. And when they were asked by journalists, why did you do that? Do you really think he's going to help you? They said, no, we don't think he's going to help us, but we wanted to send a message because Hillary ain't going to help us either. So we were just sending a message. There's a lot more of that than people realize.
Yeah, and that's legitimate. I mean, I confess, I underestimated how much damage Trump would do, but I was sympathetic to that message. I personally didn't vote in that election either because I couldn't bring myself to vote for Hillary Clinton, particularly in Washington, D.C., where, the Electoral College is obviously, the Democrats going to win.
Well, if you look at it, the thing that no one wants to really look at with the 2016 election is that Trump, if you looked at his sort of economic policy and what he was saying, he was running to the left of Clinton on that one issue.
He was, and it was, and in fact, you could also say, I've talked to, there aren't a lot of people in the union movement who will say this because it's like just, heretic, but on trade, one could make an argument that he's not only running to the left of Biden, but that his policies have been better than Democratic policies would be. You could also say on criminal justice, Biden and Harris have such horrible records. The First Step Act really was that, that Trump, signed off on. It was actually an important move. It did have real world consequences. And so there are people certainly I would say the majority of people in the criminal justice world would not say they would vote for Trump. But that's something that was a real accomplishment. On foreign policy, I find the argument that I hear from some people on the left that, Trump's running to the right, running to the left of Biden. I find that pretty dumb because, Biden's foreign policy is going to be terrible, but Trump he ran to the left of Hillary Clinton in many ways on foreign policy. And he's talked a good talk on certain issues, but he hasn't followed through on anything. There's just endless drone attacks and
Forever wars haven't ended under him. Biden has said it's not going to end under him either.
So. Yeah. So, it's really hard to say who's worse. They're both horrendous. There's a general contempt, for, and well-deserved contempt for both parties. But I think the media has really One thing that is true, I am not a fan of Trump at all. I will not vote. I didn't vote for him in 2016, won't vote for him in 2020, find his politics overwhelmingly abhorrent. But the media has been reckless. And the media, I think, has in many ways helped Trump because they've published so many stories that had to be, often not even retracted. Like the bounty story has not been confirmed. And you've got the NSA saying, we have nothing to confirm it. So many stories have run on the basis of unnamed sources that his base, but also many Americans in general, they may not even like Trump, but there's just people are immune to these stories now. It's like the boy who cried wolf. I mean, stories come out and it's like, oh shit, it turned out that wasn't true. Or gee, is it, there's really no way to evaluate it.
Well, that's the problem to me with the 24/7 news cycle at this point. I mean, all the journalists now are scrambling to get stories. And if you're on a 24/7 news cycle, you just need to get it out there. And as a result, you're going to get a bunch of stories that, don't really have enough meat to them. And it's created this really bad situation where, people don't like to talk about it, but there's a lot of distrust of media in this country. The media's approval ratings aren't that great either.
They're lower than I checked this recently. I mean, it was a Gallup poll. The media's ratings are lower than Congress. I mean, that's pretty damn hard to do. So people just don't try. It was on who you trusted, and the media came in lower than Congress. That's pretty sad. And so it's not just Trump supporters who don't trust the media. I mean, it's much more widely spread. So, and there's good reason for it. And there was, I will just say, I do believe that there was a media, that the media bought into a anti-Trump narrative from the get-go and was complicit in trying to block his election, and then afterwards immediately moved into let's pursue stories that can lead to his impeachment. And that led to a lot of reckless stories. I mean, look, the media is, again, I don't want to come off as like, the media is universally bad. I mean, I've been in the journalism business. I worked for the Los Angeles Times. I've written for mainstream outlets. But I think that media at the high end level, like most wealthy people in this country, would prefer Biden and preferred Hillary to Trump because Trump is a loose cannon.
Do you think that some of the media backlash is just personal in the sense that, I mean, Trump did on the campaign trail sort of, make fun of the media and sort of go after journalists. And I think they just really got PO'd about that. And, it's become a personal thing with the media versus Trump.
Well, that may be partly true, but I think it's just there was a real, and one could argue that this is a fair point of view, but I do believe it corrupted the media coverage of Trump.
I agree, yeah.
Yeah. Like, I think there have been so many stories that have been published that would never have been published if they were about Obama. Like, for example, the Atlantic's recent story about Trump refusing to go to visit the graveyard where Marines were buried at this famous battle, World War One battle.
And I was going to ask about that.
Well, that's just a ridiculous story. I mean, parts of it may be true, but parts of it are clearly false. And that's not really a good standard of journalism. I mean, Jeffrey Goldberg is one of my least favorite journalists. And of course, has spectacularly failed upward throughout his entire career.
This is the guy who pushed for the Iraq War. The big thing for me with Goldberg is, to me, he's just a water carrier for the Saudis. And I don't like that. I don't like how he did that slobbering at the mouth interview with Prince Mohammed bin Salman a few years ago. It's just, it's ridiculous.
I remember the Tom Friedman one. I don't even remember. I try not to read Goldberg, so maybe I just missed it. But no, he is a water carrier. I think it's more about Israel. I mean, he was once in an Israeli prison guard. But I think it's related to that then. So you see a sympathy towards the Saudi, a hatred of the Iranians. but Goldberg, that story, you know, that's an extraordinary charge to make, that he didn't go to the graveyard because he didn't want his, you know, the weather was bad and he didn't want to get his hair mussed. Well, I'm really sorry. That's the lead to your story. And that, you know, John Bolton, who hates Trump, I'm not a fan of Bolton.
He worked in his administration, and even he said,
he was
go
there.
On.
His account of it just does not square with Goldberg's account, and Goldberg has had to admit, well, maybe that part wasn't right. Well, that's the lead to your story, and that's just incredibly damaging. You've got four unnamed sources. Well, these sources were wrong. Everyone in the room has said, who was in the room, and of course you can write off most of them as well. They're Trump, you know, they worked for Trump, but they don't all like Trump, and Bolton, in fact, attested them. And Bolton even said, if that story was true, I would have written a whole chapter about it in my memoir. And so, you know, to be throwing around a charge like that is really serious. And, you know, there were other parts of that story that seem highly, highly dubious. I can imagine Trump saying some really offensive things, but, you know, you can't, like, that's the lead to your story. And it's just wrong. So it just generates this incredible distrust of the media. So the next time a story comes around, people go, oh, yeah, it's another bullshit story by the liberal media. Some of those bullshit stories aren't bullshit. They're correct. But people write them off. And not, you know, Trump supporters in particular, but not just Trump supporters. I think there's just an incredible cynicism about the media in general. And it's well deserved, because the media has devolved, you know, it's you know, everybody's taken sides.
I was going to add real quick here, even the way the Goldberg story was covered on like CNN, where he said that, you know, he interviewed a bunch of people off the record because they didn't want to be inundated with angry tweets and all the rest. So he just let them be off the record. Well, does that fly anywhere else?
That is I'm glad you brought that up. That is so ridiculous. I mean, you know, I understand when people say, and I've certainly used unnamed sources. I understand when people say, look, if my name comes out, I'll lose my job. I need this job. This is how I support my family. Or if it's an administration official or a former official, you know, there are various reasons that people want to remain anonymous.
But angry tweets on Twitter.
That just doesn't cut it. That doesn't cut it. That's not a legitimate reason. And that there's no way that, again, I mean, can you imagine if someone had gone to Jeffrey Goldberg as the editor of The Atlantic with a story about Obama that was that explosive and said, hey, I've got four, they're great sources, I really trust them, but they won't go on the record because they're afraid of people will be mean to them on Twitter. There's no way he would have published it. I mean, that's just indisputable. It was a reckless, irresponsible, and at least partially false story. And it backfires.
Go on.
And it backfires because it just convinces people that nothing they read can be trusted. You know, this is, the Atlantic is thought of as a, and I don't think of it this way under Goldberg, certainly, but it's considered high-end respectable journalism. And, you know, when it publishes a story like that, it just casts doubt on everyone's work.
You know, it was interesting. One of my exes actually called me up when the story came out and was going on about how great it was and blah, 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 blah. The story was so great. And I said, why is it? I wasn't even discussing the story with her. I just said, why is it that Jeffrey Goldberg is now some kind of heroic figure? Oh, he's part of the resistance against Trump. This is a guy who basically claimed Saddam Hussein had WMDs. I think he even said that Saddam Hussein had ties to Al-Qaeda.
He
pushed for the Iraq war. He got us into the mess there. I mean, he has an agenda to push. And I don't like that these people like him, or now Bill Kristol at the Bulwark, Yeah. These people are now considered heroes for some reason. These are the neocons that got us into the Iraq War and got us into this whole mess in the Middle East.
It's really true, and it's really revolting. I mean, that people like that have been embraced. And Goldberg, just quickly, I mean, his MO, you're right, he wrote these incredibly important stories, important in the sense that they were seized upon by the Bush administration, like, even because he was the New Yorker then. Even the liberal New Yorker says he has ties to, that Saddam has ties to bin Laden, or he has WMDs. Cheney famously appeared on Meet the Press and cited, I can't remember which of the stories it was, but he specifically cited a Goldberg report that supported the argument for war. But Goldberg has an MO, and his MO is exactly what he used in that Atlantic piece, which is, he has a story in mind that he wants to write, and then he goes out and finds the sources to confirm this story, as opposed to finding a story through sources coming to you with convincing, compelling evidence. I mean, I don't believe he just stumbled on that story. That story happened 2 years ago. Why did none of these people who were so appalled come forward now, a couple of months before the election? I'm willing to bet, I can't say this with certainty, but I'm willing to bet he was brought that story and he saw it as being very, he bragged about how damaging it was going to be and that more is coming. I mean, he's clearly hoping to influence the outcome of the election, and that influences your reporting. But if you go back, anyone who goes back and looks, that's his MO. I mean, you go back and look at the 2003 stories or 2002 stories supporting the invasion. I mean, his story that Saddam and bin Laden were linked, I mean, the chief witness, it sounded great. You know, it was a prisoner who was locked up in a Kurdish prison. And the Kurds who have, like, not to trash the Kurds, who have legitimate reasons to hate Saddam Hussein, but, you know, they wanted the war. So the Kurdish officials gave him access to this prisoner who they'd arrested on, I don't remember, I think it was like common, you know, like, I don't know whether it was robbery or like, it was some sort of criminal charges that had nothing to do with terrorism. He gave him the whole story about how, you know, he went to Kandahar on this mission, and I think he even claimed he met with bin Laden. You can't interview a prisoner under the watch of, you know, the Kurdish guards and trust that story. B, the prisoner was clearly delusional. And C, you know, other reporters subsequently interviewed this guy and said he has, like, he's a fabulist. He could not, like, he claimed he had this long, elaborate story about how he went to Kandahar. And yet, journalists who interviewed him said flat out, he's a liar. He's never been to Kandahar. He couldn't describe the city. But Goldberg, and there were various other parts of his story that were clearly false. Well, that's the way Goldberg works. He wanted the story to be right. So he took the word of a Kurdish prisoner who he was allowed access to by the Kurdish, you know, authorities, who wanted the U.S. to invade. So, and if you go through those old stories, you find, I mean, it's like the MO of the worst type of reporting. He clearly wanted the stories to be true. He interviewed people who would support his thesis, and I guarantee you he tossed out what did not back his narrative, just the way he must have tossed out information that undermined his most recent story at The Atlantic. Because how did he not interview John Bolton? John Bolton would have been a go-to guy. He was there. He was there for this ceremony. He was in the room. He wrote about it. I mean, I'm guessing Goldberg had to have called him and just decided, oh, fuck it, I'm not going to use this information because it doesn't back my thesis. Or,
and again, Bolton was saying, you know, I never heard Trump say any of that. And he doesn't even, he hates him. He's not even involved in the administration anymore. He has no reason to hold back.
Exactly. And he was an on-the-record source. I mean, my, you know, typically, like, you can use on-the-record sources. I don't know what, you know, I mean, different publications have different rules. But if you have on-the-record sources and you get denials from the White House, which they got, and you could say, of course, they're going to lie about it. But if, you know, Bolton would have gone on the record and said, I was there, that didn't happen. You know, then that pretty much doesn't allow you to run the story. So either Goldberg talked to him and decided not to use it because it would have really effectively made it impossible to publish a story, or he was even more derelict and hadn't, you know, didn't call Bolton, even though Bolton would have been, you'd have to have been nuts not to call Bolton. That would have been like a guy high on your list because you know he hates Trump. Or maybe he'd read Bolton's memoir and said, nah, I better not call him because he's not going to back my story. But that's the Jeffrey Goldberg MO. You take what backs your story, you dismiss the rest. And in this case, hey, he's the editor-in-chief as well as the reporter. There's no oversight at all. That gets back to what I was saying at the beginning. This is a profession that often operates. It's a profession that's a very important profession, that is capable of greatness, does a lot of great work, but where there's an extraordinary lack of accountability.
Well, the problem for me is that we view things too black and white anymore. You know, it's just bizarre to me when I will defend journalists when Trump makes very blanket statements about journalists. I don't like the way he talks about the media at times. On the other hand, you know, that doesn't mean you can't criticize the way the media handles things at times. And if you say that, people immediately go off on you about, oh, you're like that demagogue Trump. And it's bizarro world stuff. There is no nuance. Everything is seen in black and white now. And I think it's a horrible development on our culture.
Yes, I agree with you. And I think that, yeah, I mean, Trump's comments on journalists can often be extraordinarily offensive and really, really disgusting. And he, you know, he clearly has an agenda to, the whole fake news thing is to cast out on the, you know, to cast out on and undermine the media from top to bottom. He has no regard for the truth. I mean, his criticism is, you know, completely unreliable. On the other hand, and this is what bothers me, the media feeds him ammunition that allows him to say things that, you know, are true. Not all of his criticism can be dismissed. He's a completely unreliable witness. You would never bring Donald Trump into court or talk to him, you know, interview him. You know, if you were a journalism professor, Donald Trump would really not be a guy you'd want as an expert on the media, clearly. I mean, he is a pathological liar. I'm not even sure he's able to distinguish between a lie and the truth much of the time.
But the thing is, too, you know, we point all this out, but then if we say, you know, there's aspects of the way Obama treated the White House press that, you know, I didn't like how Helen Thomas was treated in her final years in the White House press. She had a lot of problems with Obama. But if you say that, people say, oh, you can't attack Obama. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is ridiculous. And it's not, I agree. It's not just the media, but, you know, what I find really appalling is that, you know, Obama, this is the unforgivable sin of Obama. There are many, actually, but Obama won an overwhelming majority and came into office with Democratic majorities in the House and Senate. And even before he took office, he appointed Geithner and Larry Summers to the top two economic positions in his administration. I mean, when you surrender before you even take office, there's just no excuse for that. When you appoint Geithner and Summers, I mean, you guarantee a continuation of misery for a good chunk of the population. And his policies, his economic policies were, you know, overwhelmingly detrimental to, certainly for poor people and for a good chunk of the middle class as well. Obama, I loathe the cult of Obama. Here's a guy, I mean, you know, you got to hand it to Jimmy Carter. I did not like the presidency, but the post-presidency was pretty good. What has Obama been doing?
He started giving lectures at Wall Street.
Yeah, giving lectures at Wall Street and, you know, hanging out with the Davos crowd and hanging out with Richard Branson on his private island and setting up a foundation that looks every bit as dubious as Hillary Clinton's foundation. I mean, you know, where you're raising money from the people you did favors for when you were president. It's really, really, we talked earlier about the sort of rehabilitation of George W. Bush, which is, you know, absolutely appalling. Obama was treated very, very kindly by the press. So it's not like he's been rehabilitated, but he's just gotten a free pass. You know, every time he, you know, he offers another of his empty platitudes, you know, it's like he receives tremendous coverage. He and Michelle both. I have zero patience for the cult of Obama.
So much of it seems to come down to, you know, I think a lot of the hate for Trump is just that, oh, he's seen as gauche or uncultured. And, you know, why can't we have a cultured president like President Obama again? And I think that's a problem we see in a lot of the press, that there's, you know, these cultural attitudes that if you don't meet these expectations, you're going to be treated very differently.
Definitely. I mean, Trump was, I think that was part of the issue that the press had with Trump. I mean, you know, the classic example of what you're talking about, I mean, my God, and you talk about just like the daily scandals that are rolled out to the point that it's just impossible to, you know, take these things seriously. But one of the dumber ones was, I think it was post-campaign, I think it was after he won the presidency, but, you know, he liked to eat a steak well done and with ketchup. Well, personally, I would never do that in a million years, but like, why is that an issue? I mean, it gets at exactly what you're talking about. He's just not up to our standards. You know, it's almost like we really wouldn't want this guy at our country club. Well, you know, a lot of Americans don't really give a shit about that, you know? And I think that a lot of things that the press finds offensive about Trump resonate with, I don't want to say ordinary Americans, because this is a very, very diverse country, but they resonate with people, not just the Trump base, but, you know, Trump, I think, is seen as, and I think this is legit, I mean, I think he's, you know, extraordinarily dangerous in a lot of ways, but he's seen as authentic. And that appeals to a lot of people, because our political system is so broken. People often don't vote on the basis of issues. They vote on the basis of likability.
Well, I remember when, you know, there was talk about like the food he would eat, even before all this stuff came out about how he orders McDonald's at the White House, right, or whatever. But, you know, people would bring up to me, oh, he eats like meatloaf and macaroni and cheese and comfort foods. And I'm like, well, you know, a lot of people in this country do that, and they actually find that relatable. It's not necessarily, you know, something that will cause him to lose points.
I've had meatloaf and mac and cheese plenty of times. I mean, most of the country has, you know. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, I just don't understand these stories, and I do think they're really detrimental. And it does demonstrate the bubble that the press lives in. I mean, you know, the idea that, oh my God, people are really going to love this story. Well, no, you know, and particularly what's particularly dangerous about this, I think, is that because we do not live in a system that can in any way legitimately or, you know, seriously be called a democracy, you know, there are a lot of people in the swing states, the Rust Belt, as it's called, the, you know, the rotted out Midwest, I mean, issues that resonate in Washington or New York do not resonate in that part of the world. I mean, we really do. Like, we're a country where people just don't, you know, they just don't talk to people they disagree with, and they live in different worlds. And a lot of the media in Washington lives a very, very privileged life, and people do not understand. And boy, this is true on the left as well. You know, they do not understand what ordinary people are going through and the level of economic stress and anxiety that exists in this country, and that people just, you know, hey, eating again, like, it's all preference, but, you know, the fact that a guy likes his steak cooked well done and eats it with ketchup, there's just a lot of people who don't care about that and may even go, you know, I don't know. I mean, look, Trump is he's seen as authentic and genuine in a way. I mean, Obama certainly was not authentic and genuine. Hillary Clinton, I mean, remember when she was like taking, I think it was, I don't know whether it was beer or a shot of whiskey with steel workers somewhere. You could tell how utterly fake that was. Joe Biden, I mean, Joe Biden actually like has a slighter, you know, like he's I think a little bit more familiar with the real lives of people, but certainly he lives a very privileged life. I mean, Trump, don't get me wrong, obviously this guy has a lot of money and he's living and, you know, he does not understand the suffering of everyday people. But the one thing about him that I think resonates with a lot of people that media types don't understand is that, hey, he is the sort of guy you're like, as crazy as he is, you might go have a beer with him, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's also like when the story broke about, you know, oh, Stormy Daniels and Donald Trump and Karen McDougal. I thought to myself, you know, a lot of the dudes I know out here in Pennsylvania were just saying, oh, he did it with a porn star. Yeah.
You right. Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't want to, the bigger problem with that from my point of view was
the hush money.
The hush money. And, you know, charges of, you know, I mean, women who came forward, I mean, some of the women who came forward with stories about Trump, but, you know, anybody who came forward with a credible story, I mean, those are serious issues. Whether they resonate or not, I don't care. The hush money with Stormy Daniels was highly problematic.
But a lot of people miss the hush money thing. A lot of people only heard, oh, he had sex with Stormy Daniels, you know.
Right, right. And really that's not, you know, like, I don't know. I think a lot, you know, I really don't care. I mean, I do care if he's, I do care if his behavior, you know, if he is, you know, uses force, if he, you know, intimidates women.
If he's paying people off not to talk about
if
these
he's
things.
Paying
yeah.
People off, yeah, that's serious stuff. I mean, the fact that he had sex with a porn star, I think is, you know, whatever one thinks of it, it's not really like, you know, it's not really a, I think for a lot of people, yeah, who really cares? I think the same thing with actually Bill Clinton. Well, I mean, who I find his, you know, behavior with women to be really revolting. But I think that there were people who, you know, if he was screwing around, putting aside, and again, this is dangerous turf because I in no way want to be defending Trump or Clinton of the various sexual misconduct, which is a, you know, probably not strong enough. I don't want to in any way be defending their behavior with women, but yeah, I mean, the hush money is a real problem. If he had sex with a porn star, I don't really think that's a, you know, issue between him and his wife. And I think a lot of people just don't care about those issues. And a lot of people didn't care about Bill Clinton having affairs. I do find his behavior with Monica Lewinsky to be very repellent. And, you know, like, I mean, I'm real sorry, but there's a power imbalance in that relationship.
That to me was the big story with Lewinsky. And it's interesting too, since you mentioned Lewinsky, I always felt very bad for her. I remember seeing, you know, how the press would treat her and how people in the media would call her like Miss Piggy and things like this. And I just thought, this is, you know, over the top. And there was a power imbalance, but no one really wanted to talk about that for years. Now people are starting to talk about, you know, Clinton and, you know, his indiscretions, but back then it was unconceivable.
Yeah, absolutely. Monica Lewinsky got real, I mean, she got terrible press. And, you know, I mean, I forget that there was Maureen Dowd, I'm blanking on what she said, but she, I mean, oh, no, you know what? I can't exactly remember the expression Maureen Dowd used, but there was just a lot of skepticism towards Lewinsky and a lack of sympathy that I think was, you know, absolutely uncalled for. So again, it's dangerous turf because I do not want to be, I despise Clinton for multiple reasons.
And no, I but think, I think I get what you're saying though. You know, like, is it really the sex that matters or the other aspects of these stories, the power imbalance in Clinton's case, the hush money in Trump's case. Those are the real issues, not who they're, you know, having sex with.
Right, right. That is a personal issue between them and their partners. So, yeah, absolutely. But not a fan of either of them. But
in conclusion here, and then I promise to let you go. I know we went a little bit over. I have to ask you about one article that you recently wrote about the Jeffrey Epstein non-conspiracy. I've been covering Epstein for, I guess, 2.5 years now, even before he kicked the bucket. And I was really interested in your article. I know some people gave it flack
because, whoa, you mean you believe Epstein may have actually just killed himself? Whoa.
My take has always been, you know, there's much more interesting things about the Epstein case than whether or not, you know, he was killed by shadowy elements. I mean, he worked for the Wexner Foundation, which pushed for the Iraq War and pushed Iraq War propaganda. And there's also the fact that, you know, he got a really sweetheart deal in 2008 from Alex Acosta. And Alex Acosta was asked why, and he said, oh, well, you know, we thought he was connected to intelligence. To me, that's the key to the Epstein story, not speculation about who killed him.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of unexplored and interesting components to the Epstein story. I'm not sure we're ever going to find out the truth there, but I do. This is another thing I find on Twitter is that, and not just on Twitter, but in general, people leap to conspiracy theories. I'm not saying it's impossible he was murdered in prison. I just find it very, very unlikely. And people just immediately leap to that conclusion. And, you know, and then they're like, as soon as Maxwell, I forget how to pronounce her name.
Ghislaine Maxwell. Yeah.
Ghislaine Maxwell. As soon as she was arrested, people were like, oh, she's not going to last more than a week. Well, I don't know. Maybe, you know, her trial's not going to be for at least a year. Maybe she'll be killed between now and then. But I just don't think that, you know, I mean, to me, if you were going to kill Epstein, there were multiple opportunities to do it over the years. And to wait until he was in prison and to have to arrange a conspiracy really made no sense.
Not only that, though, but, I try not to talk about whether Epstein was murdered or not. I'm not saying it's impossible. But the thing is, I looked at the 2008 case pretty closely, and he was begging for that work release program. He did not want to be in prison. I can tell you, this was a dude that would do anything to avoid being in prison for a long period of time. And I think he'd kill himself over it.
There's no question about it. There's no question about it. I mean, and that's why you, again, have to look at, you know, I mean, suicides in prison and jails are extraordinarily common. In jails, I think it's the number one cause of death. But Jeffrey Epstein was this repellent figure. But, you know, he was a billionaire. He had this extraordinary life. He was abusing young women for decades, had gotten away with it. I have no sympathy for this character at all. But look, did he have a reason to kill himself? He was sent to this absolutely revolting prison. He was going to spend the rest of his life in jail, or he was going to be almost certainly killed by someone else in prison. I mean, he didn't really have a lot to look forward to. He had every reason to kill himself. And I just, you know, I think that people latch onto conspiracy theories. And you're right. I mean, in the end, the most important thing is whether he killed himself or not. But that is what I wrote about. You mentioned it. So I do have to, you know, I do want to, I don't know, like to present the case, there are some suspicious circumstances, but there are many reasons that he had to kill himself. I do think there are a lot of issues, as you alluded to, that I'd love to see answered. And I'm sure he had ties that we don't know about.
Well, even the way he ran his little operation of getting these young girls, I mean, that's a scandal in itself that I think people forget. He wasn't going after these young girls from nice neighborhoods. He was going after girls that were from neighborhoods that had, you know, low socioeconomic status backgrounds, and he knew he could do that.
Which, you know, it's bad whether it's young girls from an upper class background or a lower class background either way, but it shows you that there's an inequality in this country that, you know, it was much easier probably to go after girls from those low socioeconomic backgrounds.
And there were so many people within the power elite that, you know, probably had an inkling of who he was and sort of his proclivities. Definitely. And it never came out. That's the real story for me.
Well, and even worse, I mean, I'm not sure what could be worse, but it was an international sex trafficking wing. He was with helpers bringing in young women from Eastern Europe and Brazil. I'm not sure if there were other places. And, you know, suggesting that they were going to have fabulous modeling careers, and they get sucked into this sex trafficking network. I mean, it's really disgusting. There's a lot there. I'm not sure, maybe that's all been reported out. I'm not aware of it, but certainly it's been, I mean, some of it has come out, maybe all of it, but there was an international component to it too. But yes, these were, you know, young women who obviously overwhelmingly poor, who were lured into, you know, to come to the United States believing they were going to have careers, these exotic careers as models. So really, I mean, it's just a disgusting story. And absolutely.
Well, we don't need to speculate as much as people think to understand how bad and how important this story actually is. That's what I'm getting at.
Yes, you're absolutely right about that. It's about as bad as it can get.
Well, Ken, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. If you could, let my listeners know how they can keep up with your work at Washington Babylon.
It's real easy. Just go to WashingtonBabylon.com. I will say, I'm embarrassed to say, very embarrassed to say that we're in sort of a hiatus because I'm not completely, and we do post from time to time, but you know, what can I say? I've never been much of an entrepreneur, and it's hard to make money on the, you know, online news. And so I'm doing other stuff, and I have not been posting a lot. But I hope to revive the site, and I'm certainly looking at a few stories and hope to be doing some freelance work. So I would be grateful if people took a look at the website. There is not a lot of new stuff, but I think there's a lot of stuff that was pretty good and fun, and take a look at that. And hopefully
WashingtonBabylon.com, right?
That's exactly right, yeah.
Well, thank you again, Ken Silverstein, for coming on Parallax Views.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Ken Silverstein, and be sure to check out his website, Washington Babylon. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Amelia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Ted, Zach, Gratz, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, join those listeners in supporting me financially at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.